Right now on the Daily Debrief, a Connecticut woman charged in the disappearance of her boyfriend's wife appears in court. Plus, one of actor Kevin Spacey's accusers suddenly dies. Also, the Iowa man facing the jury for allegedly stabbing his wife to death after an affair. And
the evidence just doesn't fit.
A jury deliberates the fate of a South Carolina man accused of kidnapping his girlfriend.
Her freedom was cut off.
His wife already convicted of helping. The Daily Debrief recaps the day in court. It's Wednesday, September 18th.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to The Debrief. Watching all of these cases today with me are attorneys Linda Kenny-Bodden and Mike Korobanix, along with forensic death examiner Joseph Scott Morgan. Let's kick things off in Connecticut, where the woman accused in the case of a missing mother was in court today to answer two new charges against her.
Leaving court today, Michelle Traconis and her attorney said nothing to those of us gathered to watch her arraignment on new charges that she played a role in the disappearance of Jennifer Dulos. The mother of five disappeared in May and has not been seen or heard from since dropping her children off at school.
Yes.
Husband Fotis Dulos is charged with disposing of bloody evidence of Jennifer's disappearance, and his girlfriend at the time, Traconis, is accused of helping him. Both are facing the charges on your screen.
Morning, Your Honor. Andrew Bowman for Mr. Traconis.
Good morning, counsel. Good morning, Mr. Traconis.
And today, at her arraignment, Traconis did not enter a plea. The case was simply transferred.
Okay, ma'am, we'll see October 10 down in Stanford Court. If you'd sign off on this transfer slip.
The appearance came after new charges for both defendants, all because court documents say Traconis recently admitted that she could not account for the whereabouts of Fotis Dulos around the time police believe he was making his estranged wife, Jennifer, disappear.
Linda Kenny-Bodden is following this case closely with me. So, Linda, the big question is this. Is Michelle Traconis cooperating with the state police and other investigators in Connecticut, and to what extent?
Yes, absolutely. In my opinion, she is. I said that the first day when she had a bail that was, large, and she had no bail or was released on her own recognizance. No doubt in my mind that she is cooperating to get a deal.
Okay, but they didn't shy away from issuing this additional charge here. This was her second arraignment. What do you make of this no answer, basically? There wasn't a not guilty plea. There wasn't a guilty plea. Just sort of kick it down to another courthouse down the line. What does that mean?
Well, that means you bought time, if you're the prosecutor, by transferring it to a different courthouse where, indeed, her co-defendant, so to speak, wasn't transferred. And by the way, sure, if you have a cooperating witness, you are going to arraign them on other charges because you want to keep everyone guessing like we are right now.
There's the husband and his attorney. He's saying that this woman is the, quote, lying lover. Is Fotis eventually going to blame the girlfriend here?
Well, you just heard lying lover about cooperation, by the way. That means absolutely she is cooperating. Is he going to blame the girlfriend? I don't know about that, but he certainly is going to attack her credibility.
Another court hearing in that case coming up on Friday. Meanwhile, an anonymous massage therapist who sued actor Kevin Spacey for alleged sexual assault has suddenly died. That's according to court documents filed by Spacey's attorneys. The accuser said he was forced to grab Spacey's genitals during a massage. Spacey successfully secured the dismissal of a criminal case against him in Nantucket, Massachusetts, after Spacey's attorneys successfully raised questions about whether the separate accuser in that case deleted evidence. And now to Iowa for the trial of a husband accused of murdering his wife with a corn rake. Prosecutors say Todd Mullis plotted the crime after his wife had an affair. The motive, the state says, was property. If wife Amy Mullis left her marriage, she would keep a stake in the family farm. The defendant first said his wife died accidentally after falling on the corn rake, but the medical examiner found six holes in the wife's back. Corn rakes only have four prongs. Now the defendant is saying someone else must have killed his wife. Let's listen together as the prosecutors played the defendant's 911 call as he took his injured wife to the hospital. The state said the defendant was frantic at times, but that it was all an act.
Amy.
Okay, so what happened that she's not conscious or breathing?
She fell on a fork. I had took out a fork on her. It was an old fork sitting in somewhere, and then she was halfway out of the barn. Like, I was calling to get out, and then Tristan yelled, and I ran over there, and she's laying there.
I couldn't pull it out of her.
I couldn't get her out of the barn. The doors were narrow, and she
something.
So is she bleeding?
I can't tell. I just, okay. When I seen it, she was face down. She did not respond to me. Come on.
Sir, do you feel comfortable doing CPR?
I can try. I'll try anything.
Keep doing the compressions until they can help and take over, okay?
Come on, respond.
The deputies are almost there.
The prosecution noted that nowhere in the call does the defendant say his wife fell on the rake. He simply said she was injured. The defense asked one of the responding officers about the defendant's demeanor.
I may have met him before, but I don't know him personally, no.
You weren't familiar enough to know what his personality was like, whether he was quiet or bubbly or that kind of thing?
No, I don't know him that well.
The county attorney asked you about his demeanor, the way he was acting. You said he acted kind of excited and hard time staying focused. Is that correct?
Yes.
In your years of experience, you've encountered people who are dealing with a rather traumatic event.
Yes.
Car accidents, fires, all kinds of things.
Yes.
Do people always react the same way?
No.
Laughing at the wrong time?
I haven't seen laughing.
Todd wasn't laughing that day.
No.
But he wanted someone to take care of his kids.
Correct.
Let me bring our two attorneys into this analysis, Mike Korobanix, Linda Kenny-Bodden. So, Mike, what do you make of the state's attempt to inject the demeanor of the defendant into this case? Is it highly relevant? Is he acting strangely, or is it just misplaced?
I think it's something that the state has to do to bring forth just because to try to give full context. I don't know how much weight a jury gives it because I think the answer by the police officer was it's very difficult, especially if you don't know a person, to see how people react under that sort of pressure.
Exactly. And Linda, the more that I look at cases like this, I say, okay, look, maybe I can read something into the actual words of the defendant in the 911 call, but then to try to keep pressing these questions about it, again, I don't know this defendant, and who am I to sit and judge his demeanor in the moment?
Yeah, I agree with you, Aaron. I think this whole demeanor testimony when you had a tragic incident, assuming that he didn't kill her, is ridiculous. I think people see more than they want to see, and it's really not good science.
A number of witnesses testified about the defendant and the victim having a troubled marriage. One of the victim's friends even said that Amy Mullis was so scared of her husband that she told her friend, who's about to testify, where to look if she ever went missing.
She got a text from Todd that said, "Do not go with your mother. She's crazy." It was a text intended for Tristan that went to Amy.
During any of your conversations with Amy, did she ever tell you about an area to look for her if she was ever missing?
Yes, it was the same day after we had the conversation on the phone. She came to my home. She was crying, she was red-faced, she had mascara running down her face. She was very upset. She said she needed to talk to Todd. She didn't understand why he would say that to Tristan. She said, "Tara, if I ever come up missing, have him look in our new timber." And I said, "Amy, you have got to get Randy here, and you've got to go talk to Todd."
The backdrop of an affair in this case turned all the more relevant today when the man with whom the victim was having that affair testified about an email he received from the victim the day she died. In that email, the victim told the lover that she indeed loved him and that she felt like a hostage at her own home.
I know she wasn't happy.
Did she tell you how Todd treated her?
She made different notes, or not notes, but said she felt like a slave or a hostage around there.
Now, did Amy ever tell you whether or not she was planning on leaving Todd?
She said she was wanting to.
Did you and Amy ever have any conversations about what Todd would do if he found out she was having an affair?
One time, she did say that if he ever found out, she would disappear.
Were you afraid about Todd finding out about your affair?
Yes.
Why?
Oh, why wouldn't you be? I mean, if you're having a relationship with somebody's wife, you would not want them to find out.
The first medical examiner who saw Amy Mullis's body thought the injuries, rather, looked very suspicious.
Well, notably, she had 6 puncture wounds across the back,
And did that cause you concern?
It got my attention, certainly, to look at the point of entry, how that would have occurred. I was interested in looking at the instrument that she fell on.
Were the injuries that you observed consistent with an accident or falling on a corn rake?
I found it very difficult to see how four tines could cause six holes in a single impact. I looked at the spacing. I looked at what appeared to be on the tines.
And that was inconsistent with Amy's six puncture wounds.
With a single impact, it was.
After an autopsy, a medical examiner said cuts and scrapes found on the victim's body appeared to be defensive wounds. And here, that doctor describes the victim's six puncture wounds.
The first one on the right entered the chest cavity through the ribs, and that's the one that also exited the chest cavity on the anterior surface and punctured the right breast and breast implant. So puncture wound B entered the soft tissue and the chest cavity in between the ribs as well. This one hit the right lung in two different spots. It went through the diaphragm and it also punctured the liver. And like puncture wound C, puncture wound D only injured soft tissue. It did not enter the chest cavity. So puncture wound E entered the left side of the chest. It was actually so close to the spine region that it injured part of a vertebral body. And F injured the skin, the soft tissue, and it entered the left chest cavity. There were two different directions of the six puncture wounds. The rightmost wounds, A, B, C, and D, went back to front, right to left, and downward. The leftmost, E and F, also went back to front, right to left, but they went upward. To me, they indicate that she would have to be impaled with the rake at least twice. In terms of a more rapidly fatal wound, the four puncture wounds that entered her chest cavity were more likely to contribute to her death.
Okay, Joseph Scott Morgan is our forensics expert. He's with me now. So, Joseph, the evidence of the farm, the money, the affair, damaging enough. But the forensics in this case, I think the first doctor really hit the nail on the head. How did she fall on the rake twice? That's not really possible. I'm not buying that theory.
No, you can't. As you had mentioned just a moment ago, this rake actually has four tines. Prongs, most people call them, and so it's a physical impossibility to fall on this rake and sustain six separate puncture wounds as the victim has. And what else is very important here, Aaron, is the fact that just as the last ME or forensic pathologist testified to, you've got these non-communicating wounds that are two separate strikes essentially, mm-hmm. and they're coming in at separate angles. And so that gives you an indication that she was struck twice. So not just the evidence of four prongs or six prongs, but also that you've got two separate angles here. And so it's going to impact her body differently. And certainly when this thing was removed from her by the husband, that just automatically quickens death at that moment in time. Because, as you know, we're told that if anybody's ever found impaled on something, you never remove it.
So many facts adding up in this case. Joseph, we'll see you and the rest of the panel at the end of the broadcast. And still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, relatives of a Tennessee murder victim rejoice at a judge's sentence and pray for an even harsher sentence from God himself. Plus, a verdict in the case of a man accused of working with his wife to kidnap his girlfriend. The wife is already in prison, but what about the husband? Those cases and more when we return. Sentencing today for the Tennessee man accused of killing two people. Eric Boyd will serve two consecutive life sentences plus 90 years after being convicted in the killings of Chris Newsom and Shannon Christian back in January 2007. The family of the victim said Boyd needed to be kept off the streets to protect the public. The judge agreed. One relative said he hoped to someday stand next to God to watch the defendant be sentenced to hell. And now to the death penalty trial of a Florida man accused of killing a 9-year-old girl. Felicia Williams disappeared in 2014, and her naked body later turned up on a causeway in Old Tampa Bay. Defendant Granville Ritchie, who goes by Trevor, is accused of sexually assaulting the girl, beating her, and strangling her to death. Prosecutors say he put the girl's body in a suitcase in order to move it. The state's star witness is this woman, Ebony Wiley. After initially saying the victim went to pick up candy and never returned, she admitted lying to police and said she went out to pick up drugs for the defendant. Then, when she returned, the victim was gone and the defendant was nervous. Wiley looked for the victim at the store but could not find her, and she says the defendant asked her to lie to cover his tracks. The woman who called 911 after discovering the victim's body in Tampa Bay testified in Spanish. This is the voice of an interpreter's translation.
De ahí estaba yo sentada ahí, y el amistad mío se fue a sentar al lado mío, y cuando me dijo que me levantara rápido porque hay algo ahí que estaba nadando en el agua.
So I went to sit down there. Then my friend came to sit down next to me, and he told me to get up quickly because there was something there in the water.
Okay. And did you see that thing in the water?
¿Y usted pudo ver eso que estaba en el agua?
Sí, estaba al lado mío.
Yes, it was next to me.
And what did it appear to be?
¿Y qué? Lo que usted vio, ¿qué le parecía a usted que era?
Lo miramos que era una persona porque se bajaba y su cabecita se bajaba y se veía que una cabecita así estaba bajando y estaba, no, subía y se bajaba.
We saw that it was a person because we saw the little head going up and down. The little head would go up and down.
Testimony in that case resuming tomorrow. And finally, to a guilty verdict in the case of a South Carolina man charged in the disappearance of his girlfriend. Sidney Moorer was married when he began a side relationship with Heather Elvis. Elvis has been missing for almost 6 years. Sidney Moorer's wife, Tammy, was convicted in a separate trial last fall of kidnapping Elvis. Here is the jury's decision against the husband.
South Carolina, County of Ore versus Sidney St. Clair Moore. We, the jury, by unanimous consent, find the defendant, Sidney St. Clair Moore, on the charge of kidnapping, guilty. Indictment number 2018-GS-263067, State of South Carolina, County of Ore versus Sidney St. Clair Moore. We, the jury, by unanimous consent, find the defendant, Sidney St. Clair Moore, on the charge of conspiracy to kidnap, guilty.
When trying to wrap up this case, the defense tried to convince the jury the evidence just didn't fit. The defense said prosecutors had not met their burden of proof.
Folks, throughout the course of this trial, we've heard that, you know, Ms. Elvis is gone. She's not coming back. And what is that? That's not a kidnapping charge. That's something more serious. And folks, we talked about the hesitancy to act. We're asked to trust in the state's theory. The state that's tasked with seeking justice, with pursuing charges, but they're holding back. They've hesitated to act on this case. They've brought this as a kidnapping case and a conspiracy to commit kidnapping. Folks, the case has been a lot of excuses for the fact that the evidence just doesn't fit, and that Sidney Moore has not been proven to have anything to do with Ms. Elvis's death.
The state said a series of bizarre phone calls, rumors that the victim was pregnant, a pregnancy test, and other circumstantial evidence tied Sidney Moore into the disappearance of Heather Elvis.
We don't have Ms. Elvis's whereabouts. We don't. We don't have that evidence. That's why I didn't bring that charge. I'm the prosecutor in this case. I don't mind telling you. I made the decision to bring in the kidnapping because I don't have Ms. Elvis. But what I do have is I know that after she talked to Sidney Moore, and I know when she was at that landing, and I know he went down there in his truck, we never heard from her again. Now, he keeps telling you, I'm asking you to trust me. If I gave you that impression, I'm sorry. I'm not asking you to trust me. I'm asking you to look at the same evidence I've looked at. That's what I'm asking. And I'm asking you, when you look at it and you scratch the surface, there is no other answer that when he went down to that landing and she was there, whatever happened, there's no doubt her freedom was cut off.
Sydney Moore was originally also charged with murder and indecent exposure, but prosecutors dropped those charges. That left the charges of kidnapping and conspiracy to kidnap for this jury to consider. And you heard the verdict earlier. The punishment under South Carolina statute is a prison sentence of not more than 30 years. The judge ordered the maximum with the sentences to be served concurrently or at the same time. Let's bring everyone into this discussion. Linda Keddie Bodden, Mike Korobanich, Joseph Scott Morgan. So, Joseph, what do you make of the verdict in this one?
Look, they tried this guy for kidnapping. They found him guilty. And listen, the justice took its course. I, as a forensic death investigator, I want to know where her body is. This defendant had an opportunity to show mercy. And he failed to do it. He chose not to at the end of the day, particularly in light of those witness impact statements that just, they would chill you to the bone. He sat there and listened to that, and he couldn't muster up the intestinal fortitude to just tell us where her body is.
You know, that's the bottom line here, and I want to get into some of those in the debrief here tomorrow. Mike Korobanich, I think you and I were in agreement that we weren't happy with the way the prosecutor closed off this case. The evidence, I think, speaks towards the verdict that was arrived here, but the prosecutor trying to say, well, you know, I know all the information, trust me, this is a problem, right?
Well, it's a big problem. It's a problem I think they're going to have on appeal, because a prosecutor, that's called witness vouching, basically. They're telling the jury that, if you can trust, you can trust me. Don't worry about the evidence. I think the evidence was good, and that's why we're here. I think that's very, very challenging kind of summation. I think that could lead to a reversal in a circumstantial case like this.
Linda Keddie Bodden, I was waiting for objections. I didn't hear any.
Right.
Where were they?
Right. No, I was waiting for them, too. I didn't hear them either. I was actually surprised in New Jersey that would definitely be reversed. But I'm not sure here about South Carolina. They could say this was harmless error.
You know, also these things could be piling up here. Again, Linda, I keep going back to the evidence really does suggest something bad happened mm-hmm. to Heather Elvis. That's probably what the jury based its decision on.
Right. And since he was the last one admittedly to speak with her, the last person ever to speak or see somebody usually is in trouble. We had that California case that started, if you recall, at the beginning of the year, and the last person was convicted.
All right. That's all the time we have on the Debrief. Thanks for the panel discussion. Great opinions tonight. We'll be back here tomorrow at 5. See you then. We'll